This is Herb Montgomery with Renewed Heart Ministries, and we welcome you to this week's weekly podcast. Our feature text this week is Mark 1:17, where it says, "And Jesus said to them, follow me, and I will make you fish for people." I want to wish you, each one of you, a happy new year this year as we begin our new series on the teachings of Jesus in 2015. And in this year, this first podcast, we're going to be looking at the downward social mobility of what it means to follow Jesus. Now, I've chosen to begin this new year with, for me, a fresh contemplation of the Jesus story, and I'm going to be specifically doing that out of Mark, and that's for some different reasons, which we may get into in the upcoming weeks. But what has jumped right off the page for me right here in the beginning is the social cost for the two brothers Simon and Andrew and the two brothers James and John in their choice to accept Jesus' offer to follow him. It was typical for itinerant teachers within this culture to be sought out by would-be disciples. But in the Jesus story, the cultural norm of disciples seeking out teachers is turned on its head, and the teacher actually seeks out and chooses his disciples. Instead, Jesus references this actually in John's Gospel, even though we're in Mark this week. In John's Gospel, John 15:16, John has Jesus saying, "You did not choose me, but I chose you, and I appointed you to go and bear fruit, fruit that will last." What we find in this choosing, though, is counterintuitive. Jesus doesn't seek out the rich to be his disciples, nor does he seek out the poor to be his disciples. The ones that Jesus seeks out are the very ones that are in social motion. They're the ones who are in movement. They're engaged in a social mobility away from those who would be classified as being poor and toward those that would be classified as being rich. And both of these sets of brothers, Simon and Andrew and James and John, they're busy at work in a family fishing business. Few people in Galilee were rich, but most of them were relatively poor. And fishermen tended to fall somewhere right in the middle. And although these types of distinctions that we use today would have been fuzzy in Galilee back then, these fishermen, especially James and John and Simon and Andrew, they were not poor men at all, coming from poor families. They were men that were working at a family business that was run by a father figure who was doing well enough to also have hired help. It says in Mark 1:20, it says, "Immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired men and followed him." These were family businesses that weren't just providing income for themselves, but also for others as well. And these were thriving family businesses, where families involved were, by just the mere economic success of their business, they were moving from one social level to a higher one. And then Jesus comes to them in the midst of their success, in the midst of their upward social mobility, and he asks them to walk away from it all. The historical upward social mobility of Christianity is called into question by this. And the reason this caught my attention is too often there are groups that are associated with Jesus and the Jesus story that have simply become vehicles for upward social mobility rather than the downward social mobility we see in the Jesus story with those that Jesus called. And I'll try to explain this a little bit more. I was born here in an economically challenged Appalachia. And I grew up with parents who no longer were married, but who belonged to two very different social classes here. And I was being raised by the poorer of the two. And if I look back, I know firsthand the feelings of looking at social classes that were above me and longing for a means, like everyone else, of upward social mobility. And I know what it feels like to want to move up the social ladder. And I was also raised within a Christian tradition that here in Appalachia has provided a significant means of upward social mobility for many people here in West Virginia. Within two generations, I've watched even my family go from uneducated blue-collar workers, and one of them worked in a grandparent worked in a coal mine, to today white grandchildren within our family. We've moved to a white-collar world where many of our family members now possess PhDs, and all because of the benefit of being connected to the church. And it's not simply my family either. I've witnessed it in other families here in Appalachia, where Grandpa was an uneducated farmer, and now the grandkids are well on their way to becoming very highly paid doctors and lawyers. And what difference does it make? I want to be very clear this week. I'm not attaching moral value to either social direction. I'm simply drawing attention to the contrast of the social mobility directions between the Jesus story and my own experience and my own observations. The Jesus story seems to call people to downward social mobility, while today Christianity has been used to provide for people upward social mobility. And there's a danger. There's a danger that we'll excuse the religious dysfunctions of our spiritual community because our personal lives have been economically and socially improved. In other words, we'll resist critiquing our religious community because we feel somewhat indebted to that community. We feel that our lives have been benefited by belonging to that community. And we'll overlook things like pragmatic racism. We'll overlook gender exclusion. We'll overlook economic biases within that community, educational favoritism, or queer erasure. We'll excuse all of this because we mistakenly think that our lives have been improved by being part of something simply because we ourselves have experienced some level of upward social mobility or movement within the system. And the very validity of which all of this, following Jesus, should cause us to question instead. And one example of economic bias and educational favoritism that I've been puzzled by since I first noticed it, typically, and there's a few exceptions, but typically within many of the churches that I visit, there's an unspoken hierarchy between the offices of deacon and elder. It's not based on these positions are not based on a person's heart toward wanting to follow Jesus. The deacons typically are composed of lesser educated blue collar workers, while being an elder is an office that for those with higher educational and economic statuses. And this was alarming to me. Something doesn't feel right about that. And not just about the hierarchical nature of the structure, but even how that hierarchy is being expressed too. One has to question, first off, whether upward social mobility is even a blessing. If it's always a good, then why do we find Jesus calling his disciples to abandon this very thing to move in the opposite direction downward and following him? And Christianity was not always like this, like what we see today. Before Constantine and the making of Christianity into the official religion of the empire, Christianity was a movement basically among the lower classes of society. They were often, not always, but they were often persecuted by those in power or those who were privileged. And to become a Christian, for most within the first 300 years of the Jesus movement, it was a clearly defined decision to embrace a downward social mobility. You were letting go of something socially and economically to follow Jesus during this time. You were not gaining more by following Jesus. And again, the Constantinian shift changed all of this. But today we're in danger of drinking what I call the Kool-Aid of white, male-dominated, colonial, imperial Christianity that's rooted in a theology that's being defined by those at the top of our social pyramids. And Jesus instead, I believe, is offering us the opportunity of drinking, like with the woman at the well, drinking the living water of critiquing these pyramids themselves. And Jesus didn't come offering his disciples a means of moving upward socially from disadvantaged to privileged within a current system or a current structure. Jesus came announcing the beginning of an entirely different world where the present structures of privilege and advantage were to be not climbed in, but completely dismantled, where all injustice, all oppression and violence was to be put right. He wasn't just offering us a better position in a present system. He was critiquing the system itself and inviting us to a new way of doing life. He was announcing the arrival of a new world that would be marked by equity and justice for those that are oppressed within the current structure. And for a little bit of Old Testament background on this, I'm going to share with you just about four passages here. In Isaiah 1:17, learn to do good, seek justice, rescue the oppressed, defend the orphan, plead for the widow. In Amos 5:24, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Isaiah 42:3 through 4, in prophesying of the suffering servant, it says, a bruised reed he will not break, a dimly burning wick he will not quench. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not grow faint or be crushed until he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands wait for his teachings. Matthew takes up this passage in Matthew 12:20 and applies it to Jesus and says, he will not break a bruised reed or quench a smoldering wick until he brings justice to victory. And justice is understood as fairness. It's correct treatment. It's equitable distribution of resources. The Hebrew prophets, including Jesus, Jesus stands in the line of the Hebrew prophets. They speak of justice as the chief attribute of the Hebrew God. The Hebrew people were given ethical instructions, and granted, these instructions were only to the degree that they could comprehend at the moment they were given, and they were in ever-expanding stages. And those ethical instructions also need to be expanded even more inclusively today. But they were given ethical instructions about their treatment of the widows, of orphans, and strangers. And the practice of justice was clearly tied to their mission as the people of God. The Hebrew tradition is alive with examples of men and women who brought justice to situations of oppression and injustice. From Deborah, who was the prophet and judge who administered justice, to 8th century prophets who called Israel and Judah to act justly towards the poor and the oppressed, and to Jesus, who demonstrated the centrality of justice. Justice was at the core of his ministry through his words and his actions. In the Hebrew tradition, justice is the undoing of situations of oppression or injustice, and justice is rooted in the prophets' descriptions of their God's character. You can find that in Isaiah 5:16. And Jesus, too, made it very central to his teachings and his healing ministry. A central concept for the prophets was that justice, the justice of a community, would be measured by their treatment of the oppressed. You can find this in Isaiah 16 through 17 and 3 through 15. And today that category of oppressed, I believe, needs to be enlarged. The prophets continually issued a strong call for this covenant community to recognize their God as the God of justice and to repent of their injustice. And the prophet's primary message can basically be summarized in the words of Micah 6:8, where Micah says, "What does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God?" If one goes all the way back to ancient Hebrew lore, the Jubilee tradition was intended to be observed every 50 years, and the Jubilee provided for land to lie fallow, which was ecological justice. It required indentured servants to be set free every 7 years. That was social justice. And during the Jubilee year, debts would be forgiven and land sold because of indebtedness would be returned to their original owners. That's economic justice. And for a Gagarian society like Israel, the return of land and the forgiveness of debts, it amounted to an incredibly significant economic restructuring of society every 50 years. It was just like a reset button. If we tried that in today's capitalistic society here in America, people would freak out. Undergirding the Jubilee year, though, is this principle of redress that corrects past wrongs and to approximate basically equality, and it restores the human community to wholeness. And that's something that we're in desperate need of today. We have no record of the Jubilee tradition even once being practiced by the Hebrew people, but it's interesting, to say the least, to know that it was a part of their ancient stories. Looking back at Jesus, this new world that began with Jesus, it began with Jesus interrupting 12 men in their endeavors to climb their respective social and economic ladders and inviting them to rethink everything. This new world began with Jesus calling them to abandon the structuring of the world as they knew it and to embrace a cross rather than a throne and to follow him. They wouldn't gain the world that they were hoping for by following Jesus. They would actually lose it. And for them, following Jesus would not mean upward social mobility, but a downward one. It would change everything for these 12, and it should be the same for us as well. Follow Jesus, he'll ruin your life. That's been my phrase for the past 4 years. And my intention in this phrase is that for most of us, we belong to either a middle or upper class. And following Jesus for us, it's not going to be a move further up in the pyramid of privilege. It's going to be characterized instead by throwing all of that away. It was the oppressed who would be blessed by Jesus' new world. And for those presently benefited by the present structure, the new world that had arrived in Jesus, according to Luke 6:20 through 26, this new world would be problematic at best. But what I want us to consider this week is that this life that's being ruined, it's a life worth ruining for the sake of others. It's a life worth throwing away for what some have labeled as a life of holy mischief. There are greater things to live for than mere upward social mobility within the present structures. Following Jesus today doesn't mean to offer upward mobility to those who within a system, are presently being held down. Following Jesus means to abandon the entire social structure itself that privileges some at the cost of disadvantaging and subordinating others. And for those of us who are privileged in the present system, a privilege that comes at the cost of those who are less privileged, this will mean downward social mobility to an egalitarian new world. And each of us will have to answer for ourselves whether or not we're going to accept the ancient invitation to follow me. Heart group application this week. I want you to spend some time contemplating what downward social mobility for the sake of others that the Jesus narrative might be inspiring in you this new year and as 2015 begins. And I want you to write down, as you spend that time in contemplation, I want you to write down what you discover, and then I want you to share with your heart group this upcoming week. Till the only world that remains is a world where love reigns. Keep living in love. Keep loving like Jesus. Happy New Year to each one of you once again. I love each of you, and I'll see you next week.